Battalion and brigade commanders complained about the prospect of babysitting a bunch of reporters. But when the word spread that the Marine Corps, probably the most public relations-wise branch of the military, was seeking embeds, the Army joined in the competition for the best print and broadcast reporters. As the process unfolded, it became clear that the traditional distrust and animosity between the military and the media was breaking down. I heard reports that journalists who had moved to Camp Pendleton, Fort Stewart, and Fort Bragg were already talking fondly of my outfit. This same spirit was spreading on the ships and air bases where the reporters were embedded. There was a certain Ernie Pyle spirit developing. Reporters bonding with the soldiers and Marines, the troops teaching their journalists how to heat an MRE pouch on the engine block of a Humvee, and the best way to treat blisters. By late November, Tory Clark advised me there could be as many as 600 embeds accredited to the command. If we conduct this operation, General, she said, it'll be the best covered war in history. January 2003. Our force level was mounting in the theater. It was beginning to seem as if the president would commit the nation to war, sooner rather than later. I met with King Abdullah II of Jordan in his home in Amman on the afternoon of Thursday, January 23rd. General, he said, from reliable intelligence sources, I believe the Iraqis are hiding chemical and biological weapons. The Jordanians did have reliable intelligence sources in Iraq. I trusted them, and I trusted the king's judgment, and I wasn't surprised at what his sources had reported. I'd spent days and nights over the previous 12 years worrying about Saddam's WMD program and the effect that such weapons could have on our troops and on my country. I thanked the king, left his home, drove to the hotel, and straight to the comms room to pass the information I'd been given to Secretary Rumsfeld. 4 days later, on Monday, January 27th, I was flying from Pakistan to refuel at Crete when my trip coordinator, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Manny Shaves, tapped me on the shoulder. 35-knot crosswinds at Ceuta Bay, General, he reported. Looks like we're going to head to Cairo. Damn it, I said. My unannounced arrival in Egypt would cause a spin-up at the embassy and probably in President Hosni Mubarak's office. Not a hard decision, Manny. Either crash into a Greek mountainside or head to Cairo. Hosni Mubarak was friendly as always, but he was clearly concerned with our military buildup and the tensions in Iraq. He leaned close and spoke to me in accented but readily comprehensible English. General Franks, he said, choosing his words carefully, as Abdullah had done. You must be very, very careful. We have spoken with Saddam Hussein. He is a madman. He has WMD. Biologicals, actually, and he will use them on your troops. An hour later in the embassy communications room, I passed that message to Don Rumsfeld. Throughout our planning, we discussed Phase 4 the day after. A post-war Iraq might be modeled on post-World War II Japan or Germany. We considered the pros and cons of senior U.S. Army and Marine Corps officers and British military commanders working with Iraqi tribal sheikhs all across the country. And we studied the feasibility of an interim government in Iraq formed with international support along the lines of Hamid Karzai's administration in Afghanistan. As in Afghanistan, I knew that humanitarian assistance and reconstruction, linked to security, would become top priorities as soon as major combat operations ended. And our planning assumption was that we would guide the Iraqi interim government in building a military and a paramilitary security force drawn from the better units of the defeated regular army. These units would serve side by side with coalition forces to restore order and prevent clashes among the religious and ethnic factions, just as the Northern Alliance and anti-Taliban Pashtun opposition groups were forming a new Afghan National Army. Reconstruction, including a host of New Deal-style public works projects, would be required to employ large numbers of Iraqis to jumpstart momentum to build a new Iraq. With a disciplined Arabic-speaking security force cooperating with the coalition military, the stage would be set for reconstruction nationwide. Heads of households would have jobs, living wages to feed their families, and the chance to send their children to school rather than putting them to work as child labor. Iraqis would have a stake in the future of a free Iraq. There was no question. Phase 4 would be a crucial period. Having won the war, we would have to secure the peace. And securing the peace would not be easy in a country that had been raped and massacred for more than 3 decades under Saddam Hussein. There were deep divisions among the Sunnis and Shias, Kurds and Arabs, between the haves and have-nots. The region's traditional tribal rivalries would be hard to overcome. It would take time, perhaps years, and the costs would be high, certainly in money and conceivably in lives. There was no doubt about the actions that would be required during hostilities, from D-Day through Phase 3. Coalition military leaders across Iraq would provide civil affairs expertise, governance assistance, security, and humanitarian assistance to millions of Iraqis. Our conventional forces and special forces teams had the capability and the expertise to accomplish these tasks, and Gene Renwart's 50-pound brains had done a masterful job in identifying and providing the resources to coalition units to do the job. Given our key policy goal of establishing a representative government in Iraq, though, it would be necessary during Phase 4 to establish civilian control across the country as soon as possible. The questions were, how long would it be necessary to maintain military rule in Iraq? How quickly could the Iraqis take over? What form should a provisional authority take? These were tough questions, and there was no easy recipe for the answers. On one hand, larger coalition military forces and martial law might be required to stay in country for years in order to preserve security. On the other, the Iraqis might claim their country as their own. They might welcome the liberation and organize themselves swiftly to control Iraq without coalition help. These problems commanded hours and days of discussion and debate among Central Command planners and Washington officials. If a true consensus leader, a kind of Iraqi Hamid Karzai, could be located, then a representative government might be possible in the short term. Majority and minority factions would be represented, and Iraq would become a model for the Arab Muslim world. But where to find that consensus leader? Many in Washington considered Ahmed Chalabi a likely choice. Chalabi had risen to prominence after Congress passed and President Bill Clinton signed the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998. The legislation declared that it would be the policy of the United States to seek to remove the Saddam Hussein regime from power in Iraq and to replace it with a democratic government. The act directed the president to designate one or more suitable Iraqi opposition organizations to receive assistance. Chalabi's umbrella, Iraqi National Congress, led mainly by anti-Saddam exiles, was designated such a group. But Chalabi had his fervent detractors in both the State Department and the CIA. They cited his trail of questionable financial dealings over a span of years in the Middle East and doubted that he had maintained the close contacts inside Iraq that he claimed, especially because he had not lived in the country for over 30 years. In many ways, Chalabi suffered the fate of other exile emigre leaders, from white Russians in 1920s Paris to the Gaullist Free French in England during World War II. No matter how sincerely he may have desired to liberate his homeland, he was badly out of touch with what it would take to do so. I met Chalabi only once, and while I was impressed by his sincerity, I was disappointed by his obvious view of his own importance and his stated opinion that he could easily rally Iraq around himself. He might be a good man, but I knew enough about the difficulties Iraq faced to see him as naive. And many leaders in the region were uniformly set against Chalabi as an outsider, a Gucci leader who would never be able to unite the ethnic and religious factions. In Washington, the battle lines were drawn. With no Iraqi Karzai in evidence, the debate between the State and Defense Departments continued. Meanwhile, America drew closer to war. Iraq's new leadership would have to be identified on the fly, even as the military liberation was underway. Perhaps an Iraqi general would step forward, or a figure from the educated elite. However it played out, of course, a provisional authority would be required. As I read the newspaper stories and watched the TV news channels wring their hands over the prospect that I would serve as the so-called MacArthur of Iraq, I weighed the obvious pluses and minuses of such an occupation. Improved security. Under control of a perceived occupying bully. Improved near-term efficiency, giving rise to longer-term dependency. Improved ability to dispense reconstruction funding, with greatly reduced ability to obtain such funding from the U.S. Congress or the international community. I could see no elegant solution to this very complex problem. Civilian control of government has long been an American value. How to move Iraq forward using this distinctly American model was problematic. One thing was certain, however. Phase 4 would require civilian leadership. In addition to boots on the ground, we would need wingtips on the ground. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of civilians from America and the international community, from governmental advisors to eager investors. Key to all of this, of course, would be security. But security would not be possible in Iraq without immediate reconstruction and civic action. The military coalition would liberate Iraq, set conditions for civilian authority to stand up a provisional government supported by coalition stability forces, and provide security until Iraq could field her own security forces, a common-sense approach to a complex problem. I sat alone in my office in the prefab headquarters near the Joint Operations Center in the warehouse at Camp Ossalia, Qatar, watching George Bush address the nation and the world. It was before dawn on Tuesday, March 18, 2003, in Qatar, primetime Monday night in the States. The president traced the Iraqi regime's history of reckless aggression, and then he issued the ultimatum we had discussed 2 weeks earlier in the White House. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours, Bush said. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict commenced at a time of our choosing. The clock was running. I was about to command American troops in battle once more, but this time I would not ride in an armored personnel carrier through the jungle in Vietnam, or in a Humvee across the gravel beds of the Wadi al-Batin. I would watch the battle on wide plasma screens, far from the rattle of the guns, the blasts of shells, the screams of the wounded. I would be physically safe, but I would share in the fatigue, the elation, and the fears of my troops. Our final pre-war video teleconference was ending on the afternoon of Wednesday, March 19, 2003. "Mr. President," I said, facing George Bush through the secure video teleconference link, "this force is ready. D-Day, H hour, is 2100 hours tonight, Iraqi time, 1800 hours Greenwich Mean, 1300 hours East Coast time." President Bush nodded to the members of the National Security Council seated with him in Washington, then turned to me. "All right, for the sake of peace in the world and security for our country and the rest of the free world." He paused. His advisors listened intently. "And for the freedom of the Iraqi people, as of this moment I will give Secretary Rumsfeld the order necessary to execute Operation Iraqi Freedom." Tommy, the President, added, his voice firm, "May God bless the troops." "Mr. President," I answered, "May God bless America." I saluted, and the Commander-in-Chief returned the salute. CENTCOM Forward Headquarters, 19 March 2003, D-Day. During the months of planning leading up to the present moment, the length of air operations in preparation for the ground attack had steadily decreased. 2 months earlier, we had projected 16 days and nights of air and special operations activity to shape the battle space before the first coalition armor crossed the berm. Now, with our newest plan, our Abrams tanks and Bradleys would already be deep inside Iraq when General Buzz Mosley's airmen delivered a possible knockout blow to the regime in Baghdad the night of Friday, March 21st. I knew the armchair strategists and what the staff had started calling the TV generals, retired officers working for the networks, might find fault with my decision. I also knew the decision was correct. Communications intercepts had revealed that the Iraqis would not destroy the oil fields any sooner than necessary because they were earning about $50 million a day from those wells through the UN's Oil for Food program. I was also concerned that Saddam would order the sabotage when operations against regime leadership targets made it obvious that war had begun. So it was imperative that we capture those wells if we could. But saving the Rumaliyah field would be only one of the advantages of executing G-Day, ground attacks, before air attacks, A-Day. By operating in a manner that the Iraqis would never anticipate, we would achieve operational surprise, despite the fact that we had deployed almost 290,000 land, air, and naval component troopers to the area. When I told Don Rumsfeld we were considering moving up the timing of G-Day, he accepted the change immediately. "You're the commander, Tom," he'd said. "You have to make the call." I knew the secretary trusted me, but I'd also taken some other measures to keep the rest of the Pentagon calm. On March 17th, 2 days before D-Day, I had faxed a letter of concern to Rumsfeld's deputy, Paul Wolfowitz. Although I couched the message in polite terms, its intent was blunt. "Keep Washington focused on policy and strategy. Leave me the hell alone to run the war." Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan had been nitpicked by the service chiefs and the joint staff, and I did not intend to see a recurrence of such divisiveness in Iraq. Paul Wolfowitz was a friend, and I knew he would spread the word that Tommy Franks wasn't about to be treed by Chihuahuas while he was trying to orchestrate what had shaped up to be the most complex and fully integrated joint service military operation in history. My memo to Wolfowitz put the Pentagon on notice. The presence of the service chiefs at my daily secure video teleconferences with the secretary is not helpful. "They do not have sufficient joint background or understanding," I wrote, "to be operationally useful." "I understand the capabilities of the force," the message said, "and I will use it to best advantage." And I issued a warning about leaking our plan to the media. Leaks of classified information and the views of pundits to spur me to do more, better, faster will not motivate me. My concerns were prompted in part by America's recent warfighting history. During the Vietnam War, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara and his whiz kids had repeatedly picked individual bombing targets and approved battalion-sized maneuvers. That was not going to happen in Iraq. I knew the President and Don Rumsfeld would back me up, so I felt free to pass the message along to the bureaucracy beneath them. "You pay attention to the day after. I'll take care of the day of." I was blessed with the best component commanders and the best combatant staff any four-star general had ever taken to war. And I was confident that the campaign that was about to begin was going to defeat the enemy with historic speed. Washington needed to get ready for the occupation and reconstruction, because combat operations just might be over sooner than anyone could imagine. At National Security Council briefings, Rumsfeld and I had always referred to that possibility as catastrophic success. In the closing of my memo, I had reminded Wolfowitz of the moral compass that would guide me in the days ahead. "I carry an American flag and a Bible in my pocket. I wear a wedding band on my left hand. I understand the mission and the strategic context within which it will be accomplished. I will become tentative only when directed to do so." Iraqi freedom represented my fourth journey into war. I carried with me the memory of every moment that had gone before, and I knew we had done everything we could to prepare for this operation. I'd selected and helped season the hardest working, most talented wartime command I'd ever seen. Central Command's component commanders and flag officers were versatile, resilient, and dedicated to the mission and their people. The plan we were launching was complex but flexible, and when contact with the enemy inevitably altered its details, as it had in every military campaign plan in history, our troops and their leaders would adapt. Our young people would do their jobs with courage, skill, and honor. Privates would step forward to lead when their sergeants fell wounded or dead. Lieutenants would take the place of fallen captains. Medics would rush into enemy fire to save their comrades. I had seen such heroism in the rice paddies and jungles of Vietnam, and again on the bloody gravel of the Wadi al-Batin. It was our heritage, a tradition that found its roots at the Chosin Reservoir and the frozen hills of Korea, the black sand of Iwo Jima, the shell-splintered stumps of the Argonne Forest, all the way back to the icy cobblestones of Trenton, where Washington's ragged Continentals had beaten the best professional soldiers of the British Empire. Beginning tonight, American, British, Australian, Polish, Czech, Italian, and Spanish troopers would all do their duty, and we would prevail. This coalition would disarm Saddam Hussein's regime and free Iraq. We would take every precaution to minimize death and suffering. We would be guided by the words of Winston Churchill. Battles are won by slaughter and maneuver. The greater the general, the more he contributes in maneuver, the less he demands in slaughter. We would put our faith in maneuver. At about 1800 hours, 3 hours before the special ops kickoff, I walked back into the Ford headquarters. The building's interior had the look of a high-technology factory surrounded by a refugee camp, one of 26 identical green warehouses in the mile-long rectangular compound. It was as broad and high as a Home Depot, except instead of lumber, plumbing fixtures, and hardware, the floor was covered with scores of shelters of different sizes. Some, like the Joint Operations Center, resembled windowless double-wide mobile homes. Others, the size of camper trailers, contained the offices of component liaison officers and planning specialists. My office was a single-wide prefab in the northeastern quadrant of the warehouse, sitting beside an identical space occupied by Lieutenant General John Abizade, my Ford deputy, and it was connected by offices housing my XO, Captain Van Monney, Grinch Godicke, my Command Sergeant Major Dwight Brown, and a joint administrative support staff. The command conference room with racks of video teleconference stations and matching secure voice communications was in an adjacent shelter. My small war room, equipped with plasma screens and secure commo also, stood nearby. Another office complex with cots, showers, and a kitchenette was located at the far end of the building, but it got little use. I preferred being closer to the action, the Joint Operations Center, the Intelligence Fusion Cell, and the Special Compartmented Facility. Among the sprawl of prefabs were rows of desert tan, lightweight fabric tents, all beneath a warehouse roof that was crisscrossed with girders, ventilation conduits, and wiring. The tents were state-of-the-art, exterior-framed, air-conditioned spaces. They reminded me of outdoor show displays at a state fair back in the Southwest. Some 600 officers, sergeants, Navy petty officers, civilian contractors, electronics technicians, admin specialists, and support staff worked 12 to 16-hour shifts around the clock. Most of them slept in the other warehouses spread across the compound when they found a moment to sleep. The headquarters, Building 217, was the technological nerve center of Operation Iraqi Freedom. At times it seemed to be wired as intricately as the human brain. Along the sides of every aisle ran tubular protective conduits for hundreds of miles of power and fiber optic cables connecting the shelters. The entire complex was cooled to 85 degrees Fahrenheit by an industrial air conditioning plant outside the building, and each prefab and tent inside the warehouse had its own individual air conditioning system connected to smaller plants by long flexible ducts. With its mega-channel encrypted satellite voice and data links, and its multiple secure video teleconference facilities, Building 217 used bandwidth equivalent to that of a large U.S. city. I could reach Secretary Rumsfeld, JCS Chairman Dick Myers, Rifle DeLong, or the President within seconds by secure voice or video link, and a red switch voice console connected me to the service chiefs and my component commanders at the touch of a button. We communicated by both voice and video at scheduled times, 24 hours a day. On the huge plasma display screens in the command center, blue force tracking, that is, tracking of coalition force locations, and red force tracking, Iraqi force locations, provided an accurate, evolving, near real-time picture of operational-level force dispositions. How far our companies, battalions, and brigades had advanced toward their objectives, day or night, in any weather. And this unprecedented level of awareness gave our team the confidence to exercise a new degree of flexibility. When I made the judgment that the Iraqi military was in no position to react to our early attack into the oil fields, it was not bravado. With Gene Renouard and Jeff Kimmons working together with me to measure the time and distance capabilities of the major enemy formations nearest to the Kuwaiti border, it was a matter of simple calculation. Our Marine forces, with their superior mobility and firepower, could reach the oil fields before the enemy units in southern Iraq had any chance of intercepting them. One of our main concerns was that the Iraqis might try to preempt our attack by launching WMD strikes against our massing troops, and I wanted our psychological operations effort to dissuade the Iraqis from exercising that WMD option that I believed they had. Renouard and his team had taken on the task of creating leaflets which combined sophisticated images with clear and concise Arabic text. And for the past 24 hours, coalition planes flying Operation Southern Watch tracks in the no-fly zone had been dumping hundreds of thousands of these leaflets on Iraqi positions. The message of the leaflets was powerful and direct. One showed a battlefield montage in which heavily armed coalition troops protected by gas masks and mop suits attacked unprotected Iraqi soldiers, choking and falling through a haze of poison gas that had been dispensed by their own military. The leaflet also featured an actual photograph of a dead Kurdish mother clutching her dead infant, victims of the nerve gas Saddam had used against his own citizens in 1988. The red Arabic text on the front read, "Nobody benefits from the use of weapons of mass destruction." The back of the leaflet carried a warning. "Any unit that chooses to use weapons of mass destruction will face swift and severe retribution by coalition forces. Unit commanders will be held accountable if weapons of mass destruction are used." The psychological operations shop had also produced a series of leaflets aimed at preventing sabotage of Iraq's oil fields. The front of a typical leaflet showed a well-maintained and obviously productive oil field with adjacent refinery and pumping station. The back displayed a similar facility with flames engulfing charred and melted equipment. "Attention, Iraqi military and security forces," it read. "Do not destroy Iraqi oil fields. If the oil industry is destroyed, your livelihood will be ruined." "What's your opinion, sir?" Gene Renouard asked. I flipped through the last of the leaflets. "Let's keep dropping these. More is better, Gene." "For one thing, if these messages persuade even a few Iraqis to think twice, they'll be worth the trouble. For another, every time an Iraqi soldier picks up one of the leaflets, he gets a reminder. The enemy's air defenses cannot prevent us from flying anywhere we choose. And where there are leaflets today, there might just be bombs tomorrow." As I waited for the beginning of hostilities, I decided to grab a quick meal in the mess hall. Whenever possible, I tried to have dinner with the troops, and tonight Dwight Brown, my command sergeant major, told me they were serving chicken fried steak with cream gravy and cornbread. Brown shared my taste for down-home food and country music, which was one reason he'd been with me since my time in Third Army. Another reason was that he was the best senior enlisted man I'd ever served with. But then every trooper I ate with that night, sharing home-style cooking and swapping corny jokes, was exceptional. March 20th, D plus 1, the first full day of Operation Iraqi Freedom. After a review of coalition ground, air, and naval operations from Gene Renouard, I turned to Jeff Kimmons. J2, what do you have for us? Here's what we've got so far on the regime leadership airstrike, Jeff said. Reports are coming in dribs and drabs. The preliminary battle damage assessment and imagery show smashed buildings, fire damage, burnt-out gaggle of SUVs, the types of vehicles associated with Saddam Hussein and his son's bodyguards, Jeff said. And an agent reports that Saddam was pulled from the wreckage, badly injured, maybe still alive. His face was covered with an oxygen mask as the stretcher was hoisted into an ambulance. "Let's not nibble this to death, guys," I said. "This strike is over. We'll eventually find out what happened. You know my feelings about the first reports from the scouts." "They're always wrong," John Abizade said. They'd heard my sermon on this before. Of course, as we learned later, Saddam and his sons had survived the airstrike. But it had been worth the effort. Never again would they feel secure among their most trusted advisors. Who had betrayed their presence at that location? Either there were spies close to them, or the coalition's reconnaissance system was sophisticated enough to track their movements. Had we zeroed in on their encrypted cell phones? Were our satellites tracking their vehicles' unique heat signatures from space? The bottom line was, we were keeping them guessing. At 0900, we moved to the conference room for a video teleconference with the component commanders at their headquarters across the AOR, and with supporting headquarters all over the world. Even though it was after midnight on the East Coast, Central Command's night general in Tampa, the night shifts at the Joint Staff in the Pentagon, Transportation Command, and Central Intelligence Agency Ops Center, and the European Command in Germany, which didn't have a serious time disconnect, were all up on the loop. Each principal staff officer described key ongoing activities in his area of responsibility. Denny Jackson, my logistician, gave a rundown on supplies and transportation. Rear Admiral Jim Rookie Robb gave a rundown on planning, and Jim Wilkinson on public affairs. Brigadier General Vince Brooks, our operations briefer, took notes, notes which we'd use to format the presentation he would give later at the media center. A brilliant young officer, Vince would become the voice of Operation Iraqi Freedom. I'd known him for years. He'd worked for me in Korea and in Third Army, and he would be superb in this role as well. On this, the first day of the operation, he listened intently as the component commanders provided their updates. Gary Harrell, my special operations commander, who had the most boots on the ground at this point, delivered a succinct report. Teams of operators had been inserted into numerous sites across the western desert of Iraq. They'd cut, interdicted in military parlance, the main highway connecting Iraq to Jordan, and they'd controlled the western 25% of the country. The Special Operations Task Force in the north had linked up with Kurdish Peshmerga guerrillas and were deployed along the green line separating the Kurdish Autonomous Zone from the rest of Iraq. They were there helping fix the enemy's divisions in the north. The Iraqis were blinded, stumbling, and we had been at war only about 12 hours. David McKernan, our Combined Force Land Component Commander, would kick off G-Day, the beginning of ground operations tonight, with A-Day for air operations going tomorrow. "Okay," I said, "you're all doing great work. Let's execute the plan like we've wargamed it. Do the mission. Protect the force." As the first morning of the war progressed, I reviewed final attack plans with Dave McKernan and the land component staff in another video teleconference. The 5th Corps commander, Lieutenant General William Scott Wallace, and Jim Conway, my head Marine, gave precise, complete briefings. Their unit strengths and equipment and supply inventories were good. Their formations were in pre-assault assembly areas near the border berm. Once artillery and multiple launch rocket systems and our helicopter gunships had destroyed the visual observation posts, our combat engineers would bulldoze lanes through the high walls of sand and gravel. Then our tankers and mechanized infantry troopers would move forward, using large collapsible steel bridge units to span the deep anti-tank ditches on the Iraqi side of the border. In the next 24 hours, thousands of tracked and wheel vehicles would advance north through these breaches in the berm and over the bridge spans. Their commanders combined decades of rigorous training and leadership experience. Most had served in combat during Desert Storm or in the Balkans. They had maneuvered units through training exercises in Kuwait and endless Cold War field maneuvers in Germany and the mountains of Korea. They knew their routes of advance, phase lines, their objectives, but they also knew from firsthand experience that Murphy's Law was always in effect, always ready to cause problems. "You all know my thoughts on battle tempo," I told them. "Remember speed and momentum." I'd never seen a situation where speed was going to be more critical. Saddam Hussein's arsenal of ballistic missiles, shorter-range rockets, and artillery was impressive, and our intelligence told us that some of them were likely armed with chemical or biological weapons. All-source intelligence indicated that Republican Guard and Special Security Organization troops arrayed around Baghdad were already holding weapons of mass destruction, and we could expect them to use those weapons as we closed the noose on the capital, unless we got there before the Iraqis were ready. Our speed of advance would not only kill the enemy, it would save coalition lives. This was an important operational principle. By striking hard and fast, our units would disrupt the Iraqis' ability to react effectively. An Iraqi armor brigade commander might learn that the Bradleys of our cavalry scouts had penetrated his outer defensive perimeter. But by the time he could maneuver his tanks and artillery to counterattack, we would have our own tanks attacking in battalion wedges through his operational area, destroying every tank and every gun in their way. And overhead attack helicopters and strike aircraft would kill any vehicle that moved. "The key is speed, guys," I reminded them. "We're going to win this fight. We're going to do it by getting inside the enemy's decision cycle. Remember, speed kills the enemy." The first morning of the war passed quickly in the vast, teeming hive of Building 217. Working around me were teams devoted to every imaginable discipline and specialty involved in modern warfighting. Intelligence, communications, weather, public affairs, political military, planning, logistics with all their subspecialists, transportation, civil affairs, humanitarian assistance, psychological operations, and on and on. As I'd hoped, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Meyer were the only two faces visible when the screen clicked open for our scheduled video teleconference. It was 1500 hours, 0700 hours in the Pentagon. "Mr. Secretary," I reported, "we are on plan. Our special operations forces are in control of their initial objectives in the western desert." Using a digital map, I pointed out the positions of the Joint Special Operations Task Force West, Jesotov West, teams, which had already established forward operating bases at five sites inside Iraq. "General Harrell's troops have surrounded the H-2 airfield and the highway town of Arutba," I said, and proceeded to describe the events of the previous 18 hours. "David McKernan's troops and the Marines are set to move into the southern oil fields tonight. And of course," I added, "we have air supremacy in the battle space." "What are your plans for the 4th Infantry Division, Tom?" Rumsfeld asked. "I want to keep the ships in the Mediterranean a while longer, Mr. Secretary," I said. "The docks in Kuwait are still crowded. It will take only 6 days for the 4th Infantry Division's sea convoy to get to Kuwait once they receive the movement order, and it makes no sense for them to sit at anchor in the harbor. The division is serving a better purpose as a feint force." "Well, that's your call, Tom," Rumsfeld said. "Dick," I asked General Myers, "can you keep Transcom in the Navy from blowing gaskets over this? We're already getting some rumbles of discontent. They want those ships offloaded and moving." Myers agreed to run interference. "Everyone in Washington's behind you, Tom," Rumsfeld said at the end of the video teleconference. Before turning in on Thursday night, I ordered the release of a statement to our forces about to enter combat. In drafting the message, I tried to put myself in the boots of a Marine rifleman, a trooper jolting along in a Bradley, a sailor working on the dark, hazardous flight deck of the USS Nimitz, or an airman in the cockpit of an A-10, rolling through streams of tracers to strike an enemy tank column. "Men and women of Operation Iraqi Freedom," the message began. "The President of the United States, our Commander-in-Chief, in agreement with the leadership of our coalition partners, has ordered the initiation of combat operations. Our objectives are clear. We will disarm Iraq and remove the regime that has refused to disarm peacefully. We will liberate the Iraqi people from a dictator who uses torture, murder, hunger, and terror as tools of oppression. We will bring food, medicines, and other humanitarian assistance to Iraqis in need. We will take care to protect innocent civilians and the infrastructure that supports them, and we will help the Iraqi people start anew to build a future of their own with a government of their choice. You have my highest personal confidence and the confidence of your Commander-in-Chief. You are now in harm's way. Our task will not be easy, but we are fighting for a just cause, and the outcome is not in doubt. I am proud of you, all that you have done, and all you will achieve in the days ahead. We will all do our duty, May God bless each of you, this coalition, and the United States of America. CENTCOM Forward Headquarters, 21st March 2003, A-Day. The first 3 weeks of the operation were a time of intense concentration, constant evaluation and decision, stress, fatigue, frustration, and eventual exhilaration. We all worked with little sleep, drank too much coffee, and were carried along by regular spikes of adrenaline. In some ways, those long and very busy days and nights recalled the weeks immediately following 9/11, as we'd planned and executed Operation Enduring Freedom. But the complex responsibilities of commanding the Operation Iraqi Freedom Coalition surpassed anything I had experienced as a military officer. Once we committed the force to war, the challenges and decision points never stopped. My Chief of Operations, Gene Renwart, sat beside me in the war room. It was 21:15 hours on March 21st. John Abizade was in his chair at the far end of the table. The secure speakerphone was open to Air Force General Buzz Mosley in the CAOC, the Combined Air Operations Center. A-Day had begun, what the media called shock and awe. On one plasma screen, the air picture displayed hundreds of multicolored icons streaming across a digital map toward Baghdad. Strike aircraft and their supporting tankers, electronic warfare jammers, and the Special Ops Combat Search and Rescue Forces. "Showtime, Buzz," I said. "It'll be a good show, too, boss," Buzz replied. Tomahawk land attack missiles, launched from American and British surface ships and submarines in the Arabian Gulf, and conventional air-launched cruise missiles, CALCOMs, fired from B-52s approaching from bases in Great Britain and the Indian Ocean, would be the first munitions to strike the targets in central Baghdad. Gene had a list of the individual aim points on his laptop computer, which was online with the Combined Air Operations Center and the J-2 Intelligence Fusion Cell. "It's starting, General," he said, nodding to the symbols on the screen. I used the TV remote to flip from CNN to Fox to Al Jazeera. As the icons blinked on Gene's computer, a CNN camera scanned the district of concentrated regime leadership buildings and presidential palaces on the sharp bend of the Tigris opposite the Palestine Hotel. The CNN picture erupted with huge fireballs, smoky orange blasts that spread glowing shock waves and were mirrored in the flat black surface of the river. A series of explosions marched through the government compounds as the cruise missiles struck their targets. I surfed through the channels, listening to the excited commentary of the correspondents. "Incredible! The blasts are shaking the hotel walls. Different type of explosion now. Bigger, louder." "Al Jazeera is reporting that all Baghdad is on fire," one British reporter breathlessly announced. John Abizade, who spoke near-fluent Arabic, was watching the Al Jazeera coverage. "They're saying that the flames engulf the entire capital," he reported. "Motherfuckers," Jim Wilkinson swore. That's a strong comment from a good East Texas Christian boy. Gene shook his head. "That's bullshit, General," he said, pointing to the screen. "The lights are still on. We've hit our aim points precisely. That's what's burning." As we watched the cruise missiles strike their targets with incredible accuracy, the broad boulevards and avenues of Baghdad remained bright, with mile after mile of streetlights. The Ministry of Defense and the selected buildings of the Abbasid Palace complex disappeared in fireballs, but the windows and apartment buildings nearby remained lit. On the streets along the river, traffic signals flashed green, yellow, and red, as they would on any other day. I had decided to leave Iraq's electrical power grid untouched after discussions with Secretary Rumsfeld and the President. The decision made sense, operationally and strategically. "If we have to go to war, Tommy," the President had told me in February, "we're not going to destroy Iraq. We're going to liberate the country from Saddam Hussein's regime." So in building our target sets, we excluded power plants, transformer stations, and electrical pylons and lines. This would allow some Iraqi units to function more efficiently, but the importance of preserving the national infrastructure outweighed any momentary tactical disadvantage. Every Republican Guard or Special Security Organization command post and the key nodes in the integrated air defense system had its own electrical generators, so bombing the power grid would not affect them. But cutting power across Iraq would have an impact on more than 100 hospitals, especially in the Kurdish north and the Shiite south, where the regime had been stingy supplying backup generators to non-military institutions. One outcome of this decision was the spectacle we saw tonight on the television screens, the sight of traffic signals blinking and streetlights shining along a broad, empty avenue as the multi-story Republican Guard headquarters building collapsed into a heap of smoking rubble. "International Ba'ath Party headquarters," Renwart said, "just about now." A massive glass and concrete high-rise on the western embankment burst apart under four consecutive explosions, and the new presidential palace. Another cascading wave of fireballs, their glare reflected in the Tigris. "This is shock," a television reporter ad-libbed dramatically, "and the sheer power of this bombardment is awesome." The sky above Baghdad was once again a network of bright, looping anti-aircraft tracers and the occasional smoke trail of an SA-2 or SA-6 missile. Those surface-to-air missiles might have made the regime leaders feel good, but they would pose little threat to our strike aircraft converging on Baghdad from four directions. The Iraqis were firing their SAMs unguided, that is, ballistically, because if they activated one of their fire direction radars, wild weasel jets skirting the city's missile engagement zone would launch supersonic HARM missiles that would home in on the site, destroying it and its crew. After 46 minutes of cruise missile attacks that saw over 300 Tomahawks and conventional air-launched cruise missiles strike Baghdad and targets in the environs, the first wave of aircraft arrived overhead. The bombing was led by the F-117s from Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, and by B-2 stealth bombers that had flown from Whiteman Air Base in Missouri. Invisible to radar, the aircraft operated well above the Iraqi anti-aircraft tracers, long before the waning moon had risen over the mountains of Iran to the east. More regime facilities exploded along the curving Tigris, as the joint direct attack munitions from the stealth planes found their targets. "There goes Mukhabar at headquarters," Jean said. "The Iraqi intelligence service just lost its command and control." The air picture changed once more. Now the icons were streaming toward two ridges and a steep valley in far northeastern Iraq, right on the border of Iran. These were the camps of the Ansar al-Islam terrorists, where al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab Zarqawi had trained disciples in the use of chemical and biological weapons. But this strike was more than just another TLAM bashing. Soon, special forces and special mission unit operators leading Kurdish Peshmerga fighters would be storming the camps, collecting evidence, taking prisoners, and killing all who resisted. During Operation Enduring Freedom, I'd told Don Rumsfeld that I didn't intend to spend a lot of time in front of the TV cameras touting coalition victories and narrating smart bomb videos. That went double for Operation Iraqi Freedom. The early days of the operation would offer unprecedented opportunities to brag about the coalition's high-tech arsenal, but I knew the Arab Muslim world well enough by now to recognize that such grandstanding would be seen as bullying throughout the region, by the Arab media and on the Arab street. And I believed that Phase 4, the reconstruction phase, would last months, if not years longer, than the destruction of large, cohesive enemy formations. I wanted to be responsive to the media, but I intended to pace myself for the long haul. But I did give in to Jim Wilkinson's arm-twisting on March 22nd, when I agreed to speak to 1,100 assembled reporters at the press center at Camp Asalia. Stepping out onto the futuristic briefing stage, I was accompanied by several of my fellow officers from the coalition's British, Australian, and European contingents. I opened by noting that our prayers go out to the families of those who have already made the ultimate sacrifice. After restating the coalition's goals in Operation Iraqi Freedom, ending the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein and disarming his cruel regime, I described the nature of the fighting. "This will be a campaign unlike any other in history," I said. "A campaign characterized by shock, by surprise, by flexibility, by the employment of precise munitions on a scale never before seen, and by the application of overwhelming force. Our plan introduces these forces across the breadth and depth of Iraq in some cases simultaneously, and in some cases sequentially. I explained the sequence of combat operations, running from D-Day to G-Day to A-Day, and added that we would continue to strike emerging targets while closely linking ground and air operations. During the question and answer period that followed, a reporter from a Washington, D.C. radio station asked me what was the greatest surprise I'd encountered to date. "Actually," I said, "when I got up this morning and looked at my computer and realized that my wife had sent me a happy anniversary note, and I'd forgotten to send her one." That got a laugh even from the scowling representatives of Al Jazeera sitting in a block with their Arab colleagues. Of course, I'd actually arranged to have flowers delivered to Kathy at our home in Tampa, but I'd learned over the years that sometimes it's useful to operate behind a self-deprecating facade. Operations in the entire theater were proceeding according to plan, but the Fedayeen continued to fight savagely, charging out of the shelter of towns along the rivers, firing wildly at our armored columns. Soldiers and Marines cut them down with cannon, machine guns, rifles, even pistols, and helicopter gunships often destroyed the technicals, their enemy vehicles, before they reached coalition forces moving up their routes of advance. We had learned about these irregular forces, which mainly operated in the Shiite homeland of the south, only a few days earlier. The Fedayeen were unconventional fighters and included the Saddam Fedayeen, Saddam's martyrs, a group of ill-trained but fanatical regime loyalists, al-Quds, local Ba'ath militia commanded by party leaders and National Ba'ath Party militia members, and the volunteers known as the Lions of Saddam, a group of Sunni boys 18 years old and younger who had received rudimentary military training. The enemy's tactics became even more unorthodox and brutal. Some would advance with white flags flying as if they were regular Iraqi troops surrendering. When they would get close to coalition forces, the white flags fell and the paramilitaries opened fire. Their attacks failed, and enemy dead lay strewn along the roads. The Fedayeen also resorted to herding women and children ahead of their advancing technicals as human shields. Even though our forces were near exhaustion from long days of combat, they made every effort to select their targets as precisely as possible, using thermal sights to zero in on the stronger heat signatures of the technicals. Still, some of these civilians were killed and wounded, cruelly victimized by their own countrymen. It took several days for coalition land and air forces to adapt to all of the Fedayeen's tactics, but we did adapt. Slowly, the intensity of the attacks abated. As it did, I reflected on the fanaticism of these fighters and on their lack of effective leadership. Despite the casualties they caused among our forces and the human shields and the temporary disruption of our supply routes, I recognized that it was better to engage and kill this zealous enemy along the southern highways than to fight 40,000 of them in the streets of Baghdad. We guarded the tactics of our approach to the Fedayeen as an operational secret. Jim Wilkinson didn't brief the press, and the embedded reporters covering the war had no Blue Force tracker to help them grasp the broad success of our troops. They were unable to watch the coalition's steady progress, with units racing ahead to their objectives and across phase lines days ahead of the plan's schedule. "Geez, General," Jim Wilkinson complained one day, "the public is going to think we're powerless to counter these Fedayeen attacks. Can't we show them some video of the joint direct attack munitions smashing the Ba'ath headquarters in a couple of these towns?" "We could do that, Jim," I replied, "but we're not going to." He looked like a kid who wasn't getting a new bike he'd been promised for Christmas. Jim Wilkinson was probably the best public affairs director I'd ever seen, adept at keeping the media informed without jeopardizing operational security. I knew how frustrating his job was becoming. We were winning the war, but he could say hardly anything about it. "I'll tell you why it's a bad idea, Jim," I continued. "First, we don't want to tip our hand on our tactics." Jim nodded, accepting the logic. "And second," I said, "those first couple days, you showed some video of precision munitions hitting their aim points, and it was exactly the right thing to do. But Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya would eat us alive on the Arab street if we did that every day. If we fed the media a steady diet of precision munitions blowing away tanks and killing Iraqis, The enemy knows we're kicking his ass. In a week or so, the whole world will know it. Got it, General. Jim Wilkinson was trying hard to be patient. With the air conditioning system roaring in the conference room, the communications sergeant had to turn up the audio on the video teleconference. I could taste the dust on the rim of my coffee cup. It was afternoon on March 25th in Qatar, early morning in Washington. President Bush sat at the head of the table in the White House Situation Room, surrounded by the other members of the National Security Council. He looked rested. Vice President Cheney was quiet, thoughtful. Don Rumsfeld and Dick Myers appeared tired. George Tenet was relaxed, chewing on an unlit cigar. "The oil fields are secure, Mr. President," I continued, working through my agenda. "The firefighters from Brown and Root are extinguishing the wellhead fires. Those are good Texas boys, Tommy," President Bush added. "You bet, sir," I said. "There were only 9 fires. Our special operators and Marines defused the demolition charges before there was further damage. Navy SEALs and the Polish commandos captured the offshore platforms and the big manifold. They'd been wired for demolition, too." "Mr. President," Don Rumsfeld added, "the coalition's action not only saved Iraq's southern oil fields, it prevented what was potentially the gravest ecological disaster in modern times. If they'd blown that manifold on the Alfa Peninsula, the cleanup of the Gulf would have taken years." "The Brits have Basra isolated and we're taking on the Fedayeen," I added. "In the air, we continue to use precision munitions on Republican Guard formations to good effect. Our 5th Corps and the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force are refueling, resupplying, and pushing scouts forward to continue the advance. David McKiernan's got a brigade of the 82nd Airborne securing our lines of communication in the west. The 101st Airborne will air assault north in stages as soon as the weather permits." "Tommy," President Bush said, "everybody here is proud of you and the troops. The country is behind you. If you need anything at all, get on the phone and call Don Rumsfeld." George Bush leaned forward, gazing into the camera. "How are the troops, Tommy? What's their morale?" "Sir, the embedded media provide a pretty good indication. The troops are tired, but they're focused. They haven't lost their resolve. They're dealing well with casualties, fighting with the effectiveness you would expect, Mr. President." Bush sat back. "Tommy, I want to thank you, your command, and all the troops for this great effort. Keep up the good work." I sat alone in my office watching the air picture. Strike aircraft of all sizes were moving over a wide, curved kill zone that stretched from Al Kut in the Tigris Valley in the east to the Karbala Gap in the west. A huge sandstorm had been blowing for 2 days now. The Republican Guard units were hunkered down, and they were destroyed in place, tank by BMP fighting vehicle, by artillery piece. The bombardment that lasted from the night of March 25th through the morning of March 27th was one of the fiercest and most effective in the history of warfare. But no one in the international press understood what was happening. All the embedded reporters were with the ground units, except for some that were with ships. There were no correspondents flying in the cockpits of our strike planes or sitting in the targeting cells in the Combined Air Operations Center. "I'm taking a beating out here," said Jim Wilkinson, pointing toward the press center at the far end of Camp Ossalia. "I've got to tell those reporters something. They're filing stories that we've lost the war." "Good," I said. "We couldn't ask for a better deception." "Damn, General," Jim said. "We should tell them something." "Tell them we're riding out the weather by focusing on air-delivered weapons," I said. "That'll give them something to think about. The enemy already knows what we're doing." Later that night, with the sandstorm still raging, Jim came back to my office. His face was set in an angry scowl. "General," he said, "you're always telling us not to get treed by piss ants. But what am I supposed to do about these motherfucking TV generals?" "Free press, Jim," I said. "The Fourth Estate and all of that. The embeds are doing good work, getting the troops' story out to the people. Some of the retired gentlemen on TV are just enjoying their 15 minutes of fame. It'll be interesting to see if the networks have them back on in a week or two to eat crow." Jim plopped down in front of my desk and handed me a stack of Nexus and Google downloads of TV military specialists' commentary. "Check out this dude," he said, indicating a passage he'd highlighted. A pundit's name was listed, followed by Lieutenant Colonel Retired senior war planner. I was beginning to see where Jim's frustration was coming from. "Not just a war planner, General," he said. "A senior war planner." I scanned the rest of the excerpts, shook my head, chuckled, and leaned back in my chair. I knew a number of these experts, and many were much better TV analysts than they had been military officers. The negative commentary was predictable. The coalition offensive was bogged down, stalled, stymied in the face of stiffening resistance and mounting casualties. Gene Renwart was so angry, he stopped watching television. I glanced at the Blue Force tracker, then brought up the latest operations summary on my computer. Despite the sandstorm, the 3-7 Cavalry and the lead brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division had swept through enemy territory faster than any armored force in history, more rapidly than Rommel's Africa Corps or George Patton's 3rd Army. They had attacked 251 miles in 6 days, two-thirds of the way to Baghdad, fighting through almost constant Fedayeen ambushes. The 3rd Infantry Division was now setting up for the push through the Karbala Gap to the capital, Saddam's center of gravity. Coalition casualties, each one a tragedy to the soldier, Marine, or airman's loved ones, were far lower than anticipated. Enemy losses, especially among the suicidal Fedayeen, had been staggering, and of course Buzz Mosley's air component was pounding the enemy around the clock. But more than a few television pundits were already to declare the campaign lost, the plan irreparably flawed. And one particular retired four-star